Today is Wednesday, July 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Coming up, race relations in the United States. Is it top the headlines? Has all hell broken loose?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
We talk about that with the chairman of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. Also ahead, you'll hear more about China's reaction to an international court's decision about its expansion in the South China Sea, and Britain has a new prime minister. It's all on today's International Edition. A day after insisting the United States is not divided, as some claim, President Barack Obama is bringing together law enforcement officials, civil rights leaders, activists, and political leaders to discuss ways to restore trust in communities where there are tensions between police and the residents they are sworn to protect. Wednesday's meeting at the White House follows remarks by the president at a memorial service for five slain police officers in Dallas, Texas, where he said violence during the past week has exposed the deepest fault line in our democracy. Last week's attack on Dallas police by a Black Army veteran who was angry over police killings of two black men in Louisiana and Minnesota intensified a national debate over racial bias in law enforcement.
Faced with this violence, we wonder if the divides of race in America can ever be bridged. We wonder if an African-American community that feels unfairly targeted by police and police departments that feel unfairly maligned for doing their jobs can ever understand each other's experience.
Although race relations have improved dramatically in America in recent decades, he added, America, we know bias remains, we know it. We welcome to International Edition Eddie Glaude Jr. He is the chair of the Department of African American Studies, also the William S. Todd Professor of Religion and African American Studies at Princeton University, also the author of numerous books, the latest one being Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul. Eddie, thanks for being with us. You said earlier this year in a Princeton publication that I'm hopeful that we are at a moment to really reach for a genuine democratic society, not just for African Americans, but for the country in general. The contradictions are such now that if we don't, all hell will break loose. Has all hell broken loose?
Yes. Yes, indeed. And this is just one register. James Baldwin predicted in 1963 that if we didn't do the work to achieve our country, we would experience the fire next time, what he called the fire next time. And of course, right at the year after he published that book, there were riots in Harlem. I'm not predicting riots, but I do know that we will continue to see protests in the streets. We will continue to see everyday ordinary Americans, white, black, brown, of whatever race and ethnicity, pushing the country to make real the promises of democracy. Because what is at the heart of this, right, is not only the issue of racism, right, but it's the way in which the value gap evidences itself in the context of an economic philosophy that has made every American vulnerable. So when we go to Trump rallies and we hear the anger of white working class men in particular who are dying younger, whose jobs aren't providing security, they can't afford college for their children, they're experiencing an opiate crisis, an epidemic in those communities. When we see that, what we're seeing is an economic philosophy that has left even white, some working class white Americans behind, and that it takes on a particular form in black and brown communities.
Well, this latest series of protests were ignited by the social media publication of the shooting to death of two black men by police officers, one in Louisiana, the other in Minnesota. Those who are against the protesters, who are coming out against some of those protesters, saying this is eroding respect for law and order. How do you answer them?
You know, it's really sad. It's really disappointing, and it's exhausting. You know, it's always the case, it seems to me, or at least in my mature lifetime, that in these moments of crises, what black America has to do is convince white America of the unequal treatment by law enforcement. We have to always engage in the argument to make to convince people that the claims are true, that we're not trading in victimhood. Now, there was a wonderful example by Philando Castile's mother. I think it was Chris Cuomo of CNN asked her in an interview, what did she think of Dallas, what happened in Dallas? And she looked puzzled, and she said, I don't know what's going on in Dallas. I have nothing to do with that. I just lost my baby a day ago. I haven't slept in 48 hours, right? And so there's this kind of moment, right, where people are asking folks who are grieving after we've experienced the collective trauma of witnessing the murder of Alton Sterling, the murder of Philando Castile, to kind of leave that behind, to stop demanding justice in those instances because of this broader tragedy, what is perceived as a broader tragedy, as if folk can't walk and chew gum at the same time. Right? So there's always this demand in this country that black people leave the specificity of their suffering at the door. There's always this implicit demand in calls for unity that we leave behind the particularity of who we are so that white America can feel good and better about itself. No, I don't think the protests should stop. The protests shouldn't stop until we fundamentally transform policing in this country. And we can do that as at the same time that we grieve over the senseless murder of police officers in Dallas.
How do you think President Obama has handled this latest issue?
Well, he's handled it consistently, you know. I mean, it's hard. You know, he catches hell from both sides. You know, as we say back home in Mississippi, it's damned if you do, damned if you don't. So he's tried his best to kind of split the difference. I think he could be bolder. These are the last days of his administration. I think, you know, it's hard to do that at a funeral in Dallas, but I think President Obama needs to speak to the nation and offer us not this kind of Pollyannish claim that we're more unified than we are divided or this sentimentalized notion that we're one America. We all need to look the ugliness of who we are squarely in the face.
Is this situation unique to the United States, as you said?
I think the United States is unique in this regard. It is the first modern constitutional state that is founded with the institution of slavery. So, and racial slavery overdetermines the notion of citizenship in the country. In some ways, America was never a democracy until the passage of the Civil War amendments. Some might even push that all the way up to the passage of the 1964 and 1965 Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act. But we do know, whether you're in Italy, whether you're in Greece, whether you're in Ghana, whether you are in Russia, that there are, or in China, there are minorities, there are groups who feel that they are not valued as much as others. And what that does, it gives those groups a sense of precariousness, right? Their lives are rooted in a kind of precariousness. They don't know when or under what set of conditions they will be taking their last breath.
Eddie Glaude Jr. is the chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University and the author of many books, including his latest, Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul. Eddie, thanks so much for spending time with us here on The Voice of America.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Let us see what is happening on social media now. As always, Andrew Palcheski, our social media guru here at International Edition, joins us. And what is trending today, Andrew?
Well, we have a war of words and a war of tweets between Donald Trump and Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Now, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in some comments, said that Donald Trump was a faker and said he should release his tax returns. And Trump, in turn, tweeted out that she should resign from her post on the Supreme Court.
We must say that some kind of a tweet like that by a Supreme Court justice or any judge, for that matter, is quite unusual.
It is. And a lot of people noting that on social media, saying it's very bizarre to see a Supreme Court justice. They're supposed to be apolitical. They're
right.
Not supposed to express any opinions or lean either way necessarily. They're supposed to interpret the law. for her to wade into politics is kind of an unusual step. Now, there are some inherent politics as their decisions come down, and you kind of know who are the more conservative and the more liberal justices are. I think most people would say that Ruth Bader Ginsburg tends to be more on the left side. But for her to make such an explicit statement like that is very unusual. And a lot of people sharing, even the New York Times, in an editorial calling for her to apologize and stop the political rhetoric that she's been using. So that's a very unusual step for them to call out Supreme Court justice. But this is the talk of Twitter, that this back and forth between these two figures is going on.
Well, even the minority leader of the Senate came out yesterday, was asked about it, and he said, well, I'm not going to comment on that, which is quite unusual as well.
Yes, but there's no lack of comment on social media, that's for sure.
There never is
no,
there?
No.
What else is trending?
Well, we hop across the pond, as we say, to London, where Theresa May is the new Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. She has visited Buckingham Palace. The Queen has given her blessing. And so Theresa May has made her initial speech where she's trying to bring people together. She said it needs to be a government for everyone, not just a few. Initial impressions on social media, a lot of people saying, well, it's an impressive speech. Let's see if her actions can match what she's said. And one tweet I saw, it said, love her or loathe her, it's great to have another female prime minister. So, of course, Margaret Thatcher was the last one 25 years ago when she left office. So another woman is back at 10 Downing Street in the UK.
With many saying it's pretty much the same personality as two. Very, very, very strong personality, as Theresa May, we understand.
And a lot of parallels, too, that are being drawn between the situation, the economic situation that Margaret Thatcher inherited when she took office and this Brexit situation that Theresa May is inheriting. So there's a lot of parallels being drawn on social media, not just because they're two women, but because of the geopolitical climate as well.
And also the outgoing prime minister announcing his resignation the other day outside of 10 Downing Street, and his mic was live as he entered, went back into his house, and was humming to himself a happy tune.
So he might be actually happy to be leaving, and maybe he gets some R&R and take a breather for a little bit.
Well, we, of course, when we talk about social media, it is two-way. It goes both ways, and we want to hear from you. And how do you do that?
They can find us on Twitter at VOA_IE, and they can find me at APAL, APAL, and they can find you at VOA Melman.
See, we're not hiding, although we sometimes try to do that. Among the top stories in the world, the U.S. president brings together law enforcement officials, civil rights leaders, activists, and political leaders to discuss ways to restore trust in communities where tensions have grown between police and the residents they're sworn to protect. The U.S. military deploys some 40 soldiers to South Sudan's capital. Russia denies entry to and detains the chairman of the U.S. agency that is in charge of the Voice of America. China and the Philippines have formal talks after a UN arbitration court rejects Beijing's claim to the disputed South China Sea. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on voanews.com on our website and VOA mobile apps.
Here's Science in a Minute.
For the first time, astronomers have been able to get a glimpse of a water snow line in a protoplanetary disk, which is a disk of material surrounding a new star that may later form into planets. This water snow line marks the point within these leftovers of star formation where the temperature and pressure drop to a point to allow water ice to form. These snow lines usually form closer to a star whose light overwhelms any possible observation. In this case, it was formed farther out than normal from the star, identified as V883 Orionis, so astronomers were able to image it. It's believed that a sudden and significant increase in the brightness of the star is what pushed the snow line out to where it could be seen. The astronomers say that this phenomenon is about 6 billion kilometers from the star, comparable to the orbit of Pluto in our solar system. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. We told you we were going to talk about the situation in the South China Sea. As VOA's International Edition continues, China's heated denunciation of Tuesday's ruling by an international arbitration panel against its claim of sovereignty over most of the South China Sea continued today, Wednesday, with the former vice foreign minister warning against turning the vital waterway into a cradle of war. He also held out the right of China to declare an air defense identification zone over the South China Sea, as it did earlier over the East China Sea. The state-run People's Daily said China would take all necessary measures to protect its sovereignty and maritime rights. Beijing also issued a white paper accusing the Philippines of acting in bad faith and filing its complaint with the Permanent Court of Arbitration. China refused to take part in the proceeding and has rejected its finding. China's U.S. ambassador, Sui Ti and Kai, rather, said at a think tank in Washington Tuesday that the court acted without China's consent and exceeded its jurisdiction involving the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea.
The proceedings will probably do a great deal of damage to the efforts by the members of the international community to engage in negotiations and consultation for settlement of any possible disputes.
Now, the Philippines is urging restraint and sobriety, but Asia Foundation analyst Steve Rood in Manila told VOA's Victor Beatty the reaction to the ruling ranges from cautious celebration to total jubilation.
There are many people who feel that this totally vindicates the Philippines' position and would be a very good boost as we move forward in the negotiations that must follow. Those in responsible positions, those who actually have to do the work, tend to be a little more cautious in their public statements, talking about the need to avoid jubilation, but also about how to confer with ASEAN neighbors who are affected in some way by the ruling.
China is blaming the Philippines for stirring up trouble in the dispute. The vice foreign minister said that it is the Philippines that has created and stirred up the trouble. Is this going to cause a problem in bilateral ties?
I don't think so. This is the sort of thing that we would expect from China, which, as you know, has utterly refused to have anything to do with the Permanent Court of Arbitration's proceedings. But also, the Philippines is well aware that China would reject it, and the Philippines will be looking for more subtle signs of China's interest in bilateral negotiations, which is the new element on the Philippine side, the willingness to enter into bilateral negotiations now that the tribunal has ruled.
Well, that is, by the way, a U.S. spokesman, John Kirby of the U.S. State Department, said Washington supports efforts to resolve territorial and maritime disputes peacefully and through arbitration. This is VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. The Western honeybee was brought to the U.S. many years ago. True to its name, it produces honey, a lot of it. But it's also a great pollinator. Since then, these insect imports have become the fuel that runs quite a bit of U.S. agriculture. Like cattle, they're bred by the millions, shipped around the country in hives to pollinate everything from almonds to broccoli. But all that hard work and stress is literally killing domesticated bees in the United States. Scientists call it colony collapse disorder. To help fight the problem, concerned citizens are raising honeybees everywhere they can, including inside city limits. Treva Thrush has more.
Colony collapse disorder destroyed about 44% of the domesticated bee population in the U.S. last year. That's a big deal because these mail-order pollinators are responsible for a fair amount of the food we eat. But the Western honeybee isn't threatened everywhere. some colonies are thriving in a surprising location, the big city.
In the city, we have a very green canopy in D.C. And one of the major sources of nutrients for the bee is tree pollen and tree nectar.
Washington beekeeper Jeff Miller says cities can be a pollination haven compared to more rural areas. Grassy lawns and cash crops like corn and soybeans don't provide pollination opportunities for suburban and country bees. So he took advantage of Washington's green canopy by starting D.C. honeybees, which has helped about 300 people so far set up their own rooftop and backyard hives.
There's a dearth of pollinators in the cities. There aren't a lot of natural pollinators. So to have a pollination guru like a bee is a real benefit.
Miller says a city hive can produce up to 100 pounds of honey, while hives in suburbs and rural areas will produce less than half that amount. And another benefit? Lush urban gardens.
I've certainly experienced substantial benefits to those gardens. The strawberries were just exploding with actual fruit, which is a sign of strong pollination.
But a few hundred city hives aren't the answer to the larger issue of colony collapse disorder, which is driven by stress, pesticides, and parasites. But Miller says it's proof that the Western honeybee can thrive in the right conditions.
We've helped 300 people over 7 years. We're a drop in the bucket. We were never going to be a solution to the crisis, but we wanted to raise awareness.
And that awareness has created a healthy buzz for city bees. I'm Treva Thrush, VOA News, Washington.
And that's a wrap for us. You've been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. Like us or not on Facebook at VOA Now and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director, Patrice Martin, engineer, Nick Ivanov. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Educating girls is one of the most powerful instruments for reducing poverty and inequality and can lay the foundation for sustained economic growth. For every year of education a girl attains, her future earning potential goes up by 10%. And because she is likely to share up to 90% of her earnings with her family and her community, everyone around her will benefit. Simply put, said USAID Senior Coordinator for Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment, Susan Markham, when women are educated, they are a powerful force for change. Nonetheless, some 62 million who should be attending school are not. Too often, they are marginalized and devalued, assigned to do menial chores, fetch water, and watch over other children, while boys are expected to attend school, become breadwinners, and represent the family in public gatherings and forums, said Senior Coordinator Markham. To change this dynamic, we must focus on promoting gender equality and women's empowerment worldwide, while also engaging men and boys. But women's empowerment is critical to our core mission of ending extreme poverty and promoting resilient, democratic societies with healthy, well-educated citizens. These are some of the reasons why U.S. foreign policy prioritizes gender equality and the advancement of women and girls. We help girls access primary education, including those living in crisis or conflict-affected areas. Our reading programs ensure that girls have literacy skills that are foundational for future learning and success. We also support workforce development programs, which will help girls gain better jobs. From birth to adulthood, girls face innumerable obstacles that boys do not. We document and address these problems through a holistic approach, which encompasses the interconnected events that resonate across a girl's life from birth to adulthood, and work to change the perception of girls' value at the individual, community, and institutional levels. And finally, through programs like Let Girls Learn, USAID works across sectors to address the root causes that keep adolescent girls out of school and limit their ability to make life decisions. USAID envisions a world, said Senior Coordinator Markham, where females and males are equally able to access quality education and health care, accumulate and control their own economic assets and resources, exercise their own voice, and live free from intimidation, harassment, and discrimination, valued as leaders, innovators, peace builders, and breadwinners in their communities and societies.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.